Hello, everyone, and welcome if this is your first time joining us here to Am I Aspie or Autistic? A podcast mini-series devoted to sharing the findings and experiences of people with an Asperger's diagnosis after the DSM-5 changed it to Autism Spectrum Disorder. I am Joanna Simmons, a psychology graduate, autism researcher and podcaster, and I am so glad you joined me today. Last episode introduced the podcast and various models researchers have made to understand how a person develops their identity, especially disability identity. In this podcast mini-series, we are finding ways of understanding this whole concept, this whole soup that disability identity is, especially as it relates to people who have received one label or diagnosis that maybe helped them understand their identity, Asperger's, and then when that changed to autism spectrum disorder. If you missed last episode, you can have a read of the show notes or dive back into that episode, because what we are covering today though is its own little piece, so you can stay here and then decide what you want to do. Before we begin, I invite you to take a moment to check in with where you are and what you are doing. Maybe as you're walking or driving whilst you listen to this, maybe you want to take a deep breath in and out. Notice how that feels. Maybe you'll notice if you're holding any tension anywhere. And feel free to take this time to do whatever you need to do to make sure our time together will be as comfortable for you as possible. If you like to really bring yourself into this present moment, you can mindfully notice three things in your environment. Taking your time to observe them, noticing them, and maybe they help ground you to where we are in this space. I feel really grateful to be able to share this time with you and share the stories of others to help increase understanding of the complexity around identity. It's with this gratitude that I also invite you to take a moment to acknowledge the land that you are listening to this upon, the traditional owners of the land, their complex, rich stories and identities. Okay, today we are focusing on what the DSM is, how it changed, and what this means for autistic people and the autistic community. We are going to look at the big picture, then focus on certain aspects in more depth. We will also look at labels in general and how language that we use in relation to our identity can be helpful and maybe unhelpful. Throughout this episode, remember, you can pause at any time or take a moment to reflect, enjoy it in little bites, or skip ahead. Are you ready? Okay. So, the DSM. DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It is the name of an encyclopedia or Bible-type book made by the American Psychological Association, or APA, that contains all the descriptions, symptoms, and other criteria necessary for diagnosing mental health disorders. It also contains all this other information to help practitioners understand the mental health disorder and more information about it, such as statistics concerning who is most affected by different types of illnesses, the typical age of when the onset of this might occur, the course of its development, the risks and prognostic factors, and other related diagnostic issues. Mental health professionals may use the DSM to help diagnose and classify individuals so that then once they've done this, the individual can get the appropriate support or understand what is happening with them. Basically, it's almost like a Google, I guess in some ways, but a lot more reference checked kind of a Google. It's like the official Google, if that makes sense. Another encyclopedia-type book that's used for the same purpose is the World Health Organization's ICD-11, which stands for International Classification of Diseases, 11th edition. The ICD has not just information related to mental disorders, but all diseases. In Australia and America, the DSM-5 is the only manual used for diagnosis and what is consulted when people might need an official diagnosis for getting financial support, such as from the NDIS or in legal settings. Other countries might use the ICD, and some parts of the world may use both or they may use neither. As these findings were done in Australia, we're going to really focus on the DSM. And a quick history of the DSM. It was first published in 1952. Since then, they have updated several issues. In the DSM-1, there were 102 categories of different diagnoses. This increased to 182 in the DSM-2. The DSM-3 had 265 different classifications of diagnoses and 297 in the DSM-4. When the DSM-3 came about, it introduced a multidimensional approach for diagnosing mental disorders. This intended to help clinicians and psychiatrists make more comprehensive evaluations of a client's level of functioning, because a mental illness may often impact different areas of someone's life. This multidimensional approach recognized that psychological, biological, and environmental factors must be thought about when making a mental health diagnosis. There's a lot of pieces that can go into the puzzle. As well as the updates changing of how to approach the diagnosis, the updates have changed what is in the DSM. For example, the original in 1952 said that homosexuality was a mental disorder. This got changed to distress over one's homosexual orientation, the diagnosis, in 1974, and then this was completely removed in 2013. If, like me, you're probably imagining what it would have been like if you are queer and it was at a time when that was believed to be a mental disorder. I guess looking back through history, it can help us understand how for queer people and for the journey of coming out in queer rights, it's been really one that's had to rival against society when it comes to this sort of thing. Similarly, so the 2013 update of saying 2013 updates makes it sound like the DSM is like an iPhone, just like constantly updating. It added several other diagnoses, including binge eating disorder, hoarding disorder, and premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Maybe you've heard of these things, maybe you haven't. I feel like I've just said the word disorder about 100 times in the last second, and I'm going to catch my breath. So the way that these diagnoses have been added and changed demonstrates how we humans are complex and changing, and even all the psychologists and experts might get it wrong. We need to update how we think about things or realize that labels, whilst they might be helpful to kind of help us understand what's going on, they might not be always helpful and they might not be what they think they are. Okay, so why is this relevant to us, this mini-series, and autism? Well, the diagnostic criteria for the neurodiversity that is now known as autism has also evolved. Here's a timeline. In 1952, the DSM named it schizophrenic reaction, childhood type. This was changed to 1968 in the DSM-2 to schizophrenia, childhood type. In 1980, the DSM-R called it infantile autism. 1987, the DSM-3R called it autistic disorder. In 1994, the DSM-4 had both Asperger's disorder and autism spectrum. And then the 2013 DSM-5 merged them all to what is now autism spectrum disorder. As you can hear, it's been a bit of a journey to the update of the 5th edition of the DSM. And I guess you could probably imagine what it was like if you were given one of these diagnoses and understanding what that means, and then suddenly that's given a different name. Does that mean that you're different now? Basically, the update combined autistic disorder, Asperger's disorder, childhood childhood disintegrative disorder, and pervasive developmental disorder, otherwise non-specified, to form autism spectrum disorder. That's what the APA said in 2013. This change affected quite a few people. It affected the medical folk doing the diagnoses because they had to learn new criteria. It affected society as some people had certain ideas or prejudices around one label, then it was changed, and then they were not sure what to say or what not to say. And what is important to us in this research is how the change affected those with previous diagnoses of autism-related disorders. So I'm going to conduct a little thought experiment, a little imagination task, if you want to play along with me, to help demonstrate how perplexing this could potentially be. All right. Imagine you're a unicorn. I'm just going to use this metaphor, so play pretend if you can. You're a unicorn. You grow up being you, observing there are some things different about you to other horses. Then you get told you are a unicorn. Awesome! You start to understand what a unicorn does, needs, reacts, thinks, how you as a unicorn might feel and live life, and how that can be very similar to a horse in some ways, and then in other ways it might be different, but that difference is okay and that's something really cool to celebrate. Then the Encyclopedia of Animal Classifications changes to say that we don't really call people unicorns anymore. It's more like we're just saying that they are on the zebra spectrum. What? You thought you were a unicorn. Zebras are different to unicorns. And what does it mean to be on a spectrum of being on the near a zebra? Or what do I call myself now? What do other people call you? What if you don't like zebras? Do you have to do things that zebras do? Do you have to say what zebras say, feel how they feel, regardless of where on the spectrum you are or not? Okay, that's a relatively far-out metaphor, but I wanted to use it to demonstrate that the change from Asperger's to ASD really impacted the identity of those people who went through that whole process of understanding their identity with an Asperger's diagnosis. Something that they didn't have control over happened, and then they have to navigate different challenges after that. But why change? Why change the DSM? Isn't it just easy to keep these things separate? I mean, aren't they separate? Aren't they different? Well, the reason why it changed is because it was recognized that autistic disorder, Asperger's syndrome, and PDD not otherwise specified were not three separate categories, but more a continuum of different needs around social communication and restricted and repetitive behaviors, where individuals range on these in severity, like colors moving through a spectrum. Because the colors red and orange are separate-ish colors when you kind of see them separately, but there's no tick box for when a color suddenly changes from red to orange. We're moving through a spectrum, it's a sliding change. And different people would look at a color and say it's red, another might say it's orange, and depending on the context of the color, as in what else it is surrounded by, that might change as well. So ASD is now defined by two domains: social communication deficits and restricted and repetitive behaviors. The severity levels are defined as ranging from 1 to 3. 1 requiring support to 3 requiring very substantial support. Now, as we're talking about language, I want to almost backtrack on that last sentence and recognize that this is very clinical medical language, and I guess the language that the autistic community is using, really coming from a neurodiversity perspective, as opposed to saying ASD, we're saying ASC, meaning autism spectrum condition. And instead of looking at these social communication things as deficits, more as differences. Differences to be celebrated. Similarly, when the World Health Organization updated the ICD-10 to the ICD-11, these things still sound even more like a type of iPhone, when the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome was also absorbed into autism spectrum disorder. So we've got these two official books, the DSM and the ICD, doing the same things about the same thing. Whew. That's lucky, because more than one change in a different kind of book would have been a lot to get our heads around. And when all of this was happening, researchers conducted studies analysing the likely impact of change, the amount of people diagnosed with ASD, how the views of health professionals might change, and the impact of their stigma and the attitudes of the public and their perception, including the public's stigma and attitudes to how people with an ASD compared to Asperger's diagnosis might be treated. However, they kind of forgot to research the views of the people directly impacted by the change. It brings us to the question, with all of this going on, where does it leave people with an Asperger's diagnosis? This change was also controversial, not because of its potential impact, like I said, of the social identities of those already diagnosed as Asperger's who perceive themselves as Aspies. There was also a number of advocacy groups, such as Asperger's Victoria or the Aspie Rebels, academic journals and books and literature, that then had to figure out what they have to navigate. Where does this leave people with Asperger's diagnoses? Well, the next few episodes will speak to them directly. And before we dive into them, I want to invite you to reflect on your relationship to diagnoses and labels. What you think about it all. Do you know anyone who identifies as something? It could be they identify as a musician, a surfer, a Christian, a yogi, a vegan, someone with ADHD, as autistic. It goes on and on and on, and we can all be more than one thing. Psychologists and health professionals are aware that labeling people with a diagnosis is a complex decision that has many advantages and disadvantages. Similarly, for us, choosing how we want to identify ourselves can have advantages and disadvantages. On one hand, from the clinicians giving us a diagnosis, it's helpful because it helps us get the delivery of appropriate services and support, such as families of children with autism in Australia can receive respite and funding from the NDIS once they've received a diagnosis. It can be used to determine what and how much support is used in schools. People who may be on the autism spectrum without a diagnosis and behave, therefore, in the manner that's perceived as different to normal, I mean, whatever normal is, may be thought to be lazy or lacking interest in educational and social activities and therefore treated differently because it is assumed people develop and behave in a relatively similar way. Another advantage is, if a significant impairment is detected early, it can help assist the person sooner. On the other hand, there are disadvantages with labelling people with a diagnosis because we have assumptions and stereotypes around them. Before the change to the DSM, some within the autism community, Aspies and autistics alike, found the distinction divisive and ableist, presupposing that Aspies saw themselves as better or less disabled than autistics. This battle still rages fiercely on social media platforms, with many autism groups banning the terms Asperger's or Aspie, either implicitly through criticizing people's posts or explicitly through their online group rules. In this way, the diagnostic label might become more significant or more focused on than the actual nature of who the person is. Here is a response from someone about the divide on social media when it comes to labels. Why are people policing adjectives in every single Facebook group about autism? Autistic, Aspergian. I mean, come on. Please leave me and my identity that I am comfortable with alone. Please. By pointing out a difference might pathologize a person, as in focus on the disease aspect of them. It might also lump them in together. I mean, how many times have you heard all autistic people are the same, meaning that they get treated the same and individual strengths, achievements, and interests get overlooked? What do you think? Have you found more advantages or disadvantages alongside diagnoses or labels you might use to describe your identity? How do you find it when you tell someone something about yourself and then they react in a certain way? Take this time to have a little reflect on that now, if you like. Autism researchers Mohinson and Mason spoke to teenagers diagnosed with autism to hear their responses to their diagnoses. Some people found that their autism diagnosis oppressive because suddenly there was this label and lots to do around it, and suddenly the focus was for the person to change and adopt this new identity, and they were receiving lots of support and pressure from health professionals, expectations around what they needed to do and act. Some people found their diagnosis liberating because it connected them to their understanding of identity. It gave them knowledge about the condition and helped them integrate that into their lives. Like, this knowledge provided some keys to a map which helped them navigate their lives. Ian, that's the name, a pretend name, of someone used in one of these studies, explained how he used the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome when given 2 years before the research interviews as part of a reflexive process to understand his self within his life. He said,
I started to look at my life completely differently. Well, I noticed that, but I never really looked into it. But all throughout my life, I was always a bit weird, and I noticed I had little habits and things. And this thing that I was eventually diagnosed with, that condition, looking back on my life and thinking, yeah, I saw a lot of it there, where previously I just thought it was normal.
Some people find a diagnosis or label helps them gain control. For example, if someone is really wanting to do their bit for the environment and refraining from using and eating animal products, they might use the label vegan for themselves, which means when they are going somewhere to eat with a friend, they ask if they can go somewhere vegan. It can give them control on what is being consumed. A diagnosis might give someone a reason for feeling different from others. Some people only wish they'd received the diagnosis sooner, as for so long, a lot of our experiences didn't make sense. We might find comfort in a label because it can make us feel part of a group. Then again, we might feel stigmatized and seen as an outsider by people who aren't part of the group and then feel like we struggle to fit in. As we've heard, whether it is an advantage or disadvantage, a diagnosis can have a large impact and take some getting used to. So maybe you can then imagine how it might feel to have your diagnosis change. Maybe you know. Maybe this has happened to you or someone close to you. In the next few episodes, we will look in more depth at the work that Olivia Smith and Sandra Jones did to develop a nuanced understanding of the impact changing the DSM-5 had on adults with an Asperger's diagnosis. I'm going to leave it there today, my friends. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to having you here again soon. for joining me on this episode of Am I Aspie or Autistic? This series was made as part of the Winter Research Scholarship funded by the Australian Catholic University. Most of the information used in this series is from the research by Sandra Jones and Olivia Smith's 2020 paper, Coming Out with Autism, Identity in People with an Asperger's Diagnosis After DSM-5. Links to the original paper and other articles I used to write this episode are in the show notes. This podcast was written, edited, and recorded by me, Joanna Simmons, with the incredible vocal contribution of Lincoln Jones. Thanks to the support of Sandra Jones, Jennifer Lowe, Lisa Levy, and the team at ACU. If you want to share your thoughts of the episode, feel free to post a comment or review, share with a friend or family member, or write to us on autism@acu.edu.au. We would love to hear any questions you have and what this episode brought up for you.